Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Stephen R. Schumacher. I represent Appellant Veronica Zamora, registration number 22052. This is a foreclosure action that has arisen under very unusual circumstances. First, Veronica Zamora has been in this property, living in this property since she purchased it in the late 90s. And everyone agrees that title to her property was transferred to another, Amanda Wasilla, as part of a fraudulent scheme. Now, the most unusual factor in this foreclosure action is that it is undisputed, in fact stipulated, that the loan officer from Saxon Mortgage, Inc., the originator of the loan, actually participated in this fraudulent scheme. And without his participation and his guidance, this case would have never arisen. Now, Veronica Zamora never agreed to, assumed, or guaranteed the mortgage at issue in this case. Unfortunately, the trial court first dismissed Saxon Mortgage, Inc. based on the statute of limitations. I'll get to that argument in a minute, but the first argument I want to focus on is the trial court's analysis of Zamora's fraud in the factum defense. Now, this is important because if fraud in the factum is established, it renders the warranty deed signed by Veronica Zamora void rather than voidable, and a void deed cannot transfer title even for a moment. Now, in analyzing the fraud in the factum defense, which is a subspecies of fraud, there are two elements that are required to be proven. One is that Veronica Zamora was fraudulently deceived. Now, the trial court, and nobody really argues against this, the trial court found she was in fact fraudulently deceived. The second prong is whether or not she was excusably ignorant. In my view, because fraud in the factum is a subspecies of fraud, the excusable ignorance prong is the functional equivalent to justifiable reliance. Justifiable reliance in Colorado is measured using a subjective standard. The court here, however, applied an objective standard. That is, a person of ordinary prudence and caution in analyzing this defense. That is error. It needs to be reviewed de novo by this court, and it requires reversal.
How about the document itself? The document wasn't an illegitimate document in any respect, was it?
Well, it actually was when she signed it, Your Honor.
And how's that? Didn't it pass muster with the title company?
It did pass muster, apparently.
So on its face, it was a legitimate title.
Well, actually, there were several blanks on the warranty deed when she signed it. It's undisputed that the price was missing from the document. The legal description was missing from the document. Even the notary block was missing from the document. And also one of the participants in the fraudulent scheme.
But wasn't it a deed, and didn't it present itself to her as a deed that transferred ownership from her to the property?
Well, this is where the excusable ignorance prong is most important, because she did not understand that by signing this warranty deed with the blanks, and that was being covered up by one of the participants in fraud, would transfer ownership to her home.
But didn't Ms. Zamora herself have concerns about what she was signing, because it wasn't the same kind of document she had signed before, and because it mentioned Ms. Wasilla, someone that she didn't know?
You're partially correct, Your Honor. And
That's better than I usually do.
Me too, clearly. You're partially correct in that she was understandably anxious about Amanda Wasilla's name on this document. She was not concerned about the nature of the document and the fact that it wasn't a stack of documents she had signed before. Now, one of the reasons is because, and this is again where the subjective standards is important, at the time of signing this document, she's in extreme pain, on heavy-duty prescription medication, shows up in Mr. Medina's office at his request, saying, you've got to get down here immediately to sign documents. He also told her, or she understood, that she would be getting other documents in the mail memorializing this refinancing. She thought from the beginning to the end that this was going to be a refinancing. Now, when she noticed Amanda Wasia's name on this document, she pointed out, why is Amanda Wasia's name on this document? And she was told that Amanda Wasia was going to be a co-signer, or this was for your own protection, this is for your benefit. She did not agree with that, so she insisted that her name be taken off. And Ken Medina, the only other person present during this, what Veronica Smora thought was a closing, agreed that this particular warranty deed would not be used at all. So she was not defrauded once with the signing of the warranty deed. She was defrauded a second time with the promise that it wouldn't be used at all. Now, the fact of the matter, though, is that fraud in the factum, being a subspecies of fraud, you need to apply a subjective standard based upon the victim's education, experience, state of mind, I would argue health, and that is a concept that is not disputed under Colorado law. There's even a jury instruction as far as justifiable reliance, and another jury instruction dealing with fraudulent concealment, both of which talk about the victim's education, experience, state of mind. And with trial courts applying this objective standard, that is error that requires reversal.
Mr. Schumacher, are you aware, excuse me for shifting gears here, but I'd like to focus for a moment on the holder in due course aspect of this case. As I understand it, Deutsche Bank is not a holder in due course, necessarily, because presumably it did not give value for anything here. But it represents a holder in due course, so that we should focus here in the analysis upon the holder in due course status, Saxon, or the trust, excuse me. Are you aware of any case that says the close relationship doctrine, as a matter of law, is established simply because of the parent-subsidiary or sister-to-sister relationship of corporations?
I'm not aware of any case law that is held solely on that grounds, but that is not the only grounds we have here.
Well, what grounds do you, as I understand the record, there is no common board of directors.
Not in the record.
No common officers in the record.
Not the record.
No common maintenance of accounts in the record.
Correct.
What do you have in addition to the simple relationship of the parental organizations?
We have the common ownership, the wholly owned subsidiaries. Many of these companies are wholly owned by one company, Saxon Capital. We also have Saxon Funding Management, the assignee of this particular mortgage and thousands of others from Saxon Mortgage Inc. also took responsibility for these loans when it transferred them into the trust pool by warranting and guaranteeing that they met Saxon Mortgage's underwriting standards. And that is another factor that has been found to support the close connectedness doctrine. We also have an immediate assignment on the part of Saxon Mortgage Inc. In blank, this ended up with Saxon Funding Management, again with thousands of other mortgages, and ultimately ended up in this trust pool. That is another factor, the fact of the immediate assignment that has been recognized by other courts applying this doctrine. And the fact that Saxon Mortgage Inc. transferred thousands of these mortgages also supports the close connectedness doctrine. That is another factor that has been found by other courts to be important.
But the simple nature of the trust would, that's what the trust was formed for. There are lots of mortgages that are transferred simply because there are thousands of mortgages. How does that defeat a holder in due course status?
Well, the holder in due course status, as I view it, is an exception to the common law rule that an assignee is responsible for the sins of the assignor. And in this case, the sins of the assignor are clear. As an exception, this the holder in due course status was established by the Uniform Commercial Code, but it really, it's difficult to articulate, but it's an this close connectedness doctrine was developed because of the unfairness of allowing the sins to be wiped away simply by transfer.
Well, holder in due course status was established long before the Uniform Commercial Code. It was established as a course of practice and dealing and commercial banking.
That was codified by the Uniform Commercial Code, but it is an exception to the common law rule that an assignee, Saxon Fund and Management, Inc., is responsible or steps into the shoes of the assignor.
And it's a pretty significant exception, is
yes,
it not?
Yes, it is.
And so what I'm trying to find here, trying to conclude here, is that there is some basis to show that in addition to value being given, that it was taken without knowledge and not in good faith of this particular fraud by one employee of one company.
Well, the fraud, the participation in the fraud by the employee is unquestionably imputed to his employer in this circumstance. The question is that conduct also imputable to other Saxon companies that are, again, have common ownership? Saxon Mortgage Inc. transfers immediately all of its mortgages. They ultimately end up in this pool. The question is not whether or not the trust document can be set aside or whether we can pierce the corporate veil. The question is answered by Stotler versus Guy Bank in Colorado. Is there such a close connection between these companies that the conduct of the assignor should be imputable to the assignee? Or alternatively, should the holder in due course status be granted to the assignee regardless of the close connection? And I would submit in this case that the common ownership, the transfer or assignment of substantially all of Saxon Mortgage Inc.'s commercial paper in the form of these mortgages, the immediate assignment and the responsibility taken for that commercial paper by Saxon Funding Management are all factors that support finding the close connection.
Mr. Schumacher, what does the record show, if anything, about the relationship between any or all of the Saxon entities and Deutsche Bank?
Well, Deutsche, its sole role in this case is as trustee. Now, it filed suit as trustee, as is permitted under the rules of civil procedure. But really, the holder is still the Saxon Trust. And the only legal entity that can qualify as a holder in due course status, as Judge Graham pointed out, is the trust. So Deutsche's role is limited in this case. It is not the connection between Saxon and Deutsche that is at issue. It's the connection between the Saxon group of companies that needs to be examined. Now, I want to move on to the spurious document argument, if I could, briefly. It is an undisputed fact here that there are material misstatements made by Amanda Wasilla in the deed of trust that renders that document a spurious document under Colorado law. There's no dispute about that. There's an argument against it, but the document itself establishes Amanda Wasilla's representation on occupancy as a material fact, as a material statement that would not have otherwise, and the loan would not otherwise have been approved without her signing off on the statement. Now, the trust is responsible for the statement because they are the proponent of this document. This is the only document that gives the trust, through Deutsche, any right to foreclose on this property. And if I could, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right, Mr. Schumacher, you have about 3/4 of a minute left. Are you all going to split your time, or?
We are, Your Honor.
Okay.
May it please the court, my name is Jeff Lippa. My client is the appellee, Saxon Mortgage, Inc. It's involved in a discrete issue. We were dismissed on a Rule 12 motion early on in the case. I intend to address the statute of limitations issue, hopefully in 3 or 4 minutes, and then cede my position to the co-appellee who took the case to trial on the other issues that Mr. Schumacher primarily addressed in his opening argument. But I think from the perspective of Saxton Mortgage, Inc., what Ms. Zamora is seeking is a do-over. She sat on her rights for more than 4 years, and as my father used to tell me, there are no do-overs in life. Now, certainly not without good legal reason anyway. And here in his opening brief, Mr. Schumacher points to two creative theories, but neither of them justify the requested do-over. The first theory is about the accrual date of Ms. Zamora's claims. We know when her claims accrued because she tells us in her cross claims against my client. She tells us in her claims for outrageous conduct, for civil conspiracy, and for spurious lien, all of which have a 2-year statute of limitations, that she first caught the fraudsters in the act in 2004. And Judge Tommen, you hit on that earlier today. And I think counsel has conceded that Ms. Wasia had real questions about the loan as early as 2004. But more importantly, in the pleading, the cross claims itself, she tells us that she knew without any doubt that Saxon's employee was alleged in the fraud in December of 2005 when the indictments came down. At that point, she knew she had lost title to her home, and she knew that Saxon was involved. And as a matter of Colorado law, that's all that is required for a claim to accrue.
Mr. Lippa, does she allege that she knew about the indictments when they were handed down? And I ask that because Mr. Schumacher says that that's really a disputed factual issue.
The allegation is that she, and I apologize, Your Honor, I believe the language, and it's in the briefs, obviously, is that she knew of Saxon employees' involvement in the fraud as of December 2005 when the indictments came down. And that's when the indictments came down. Certainly, that would, I would argue, regardless of whether, well, that is a good indication that she knew in December of 2005, and I think the way it's pled is certainly an indication that that's what she knew. At no time did Ms. Zamora seek to amend the cross claims against my client to actually clarify when she knew, and that's all we have to go on, and all she said was she knew as of December 2005 when the indictments came down. And certainly it's important to note that the cross claims weren't actually filed until November of 2009, so we're still talking about nearly 4 years after December of 2005 on claims that have a 2-year statute of limitations. Mr. Schumacher has articulated in his briefing this new damages theory, that there, any damages that were caused to Ms. Zamora in 2005 were somehow cured by the quitclaim deeds, and that new damages arose in 2006. But again, the Palisades case, I think, dispenses with that argument. All that's required under Colorado law is that you knew that some damages had been sustained. Clearly, the loss of her property, which she knew about, is some damages that should have put her on notice against her for her claims against my client. Briefly, Your Honors, I want to address the second issue, which is the relation back issue. Ms. Zamora has asserted a two-step relation back argument, both of which must fail. First, she argues that her cross claims from 2009 should relate back to an answer filed not against Saxon, but against Deutsche Bank in 2008. But I think the important thing to note here is that those aren't really, what she asserted against my client aren't really cross claims. We weren't a defendant in the first place. And they're not really third party claims because they're not in the nature of an indemnity. They should have been brought as a separate action. And by trying to relate them back now to an answer filed by Deutsche Bank, we would be allowing Ms. Zamora to do indirectly that which she can't do directly, which would be to bring claims in 2009 against my client Saxon for actions that happened in 2004. The second step of the relation back argument is that she wants to change the party. She says that there's a mistake, that she meant to sue Saxon all along. But again, her allegations simply don't support this mistake theory, which is required by Rule 15, because she's not saying I accidentally sued Deutsche Bank instead of Saxon. Now she's saying, and in fact she has, sued both of our clients and continues to pursue claims against both of our clients, belying any argument that there was a mistake, which is a requisite of Rule 15 for the type of relation back that she's seeking. I will just close by saying that such a long amount of time had passed, more than 4 years, and in order for the statute of limitations not to be a bar to her claims. She has to be right, Ms. Zamora, that is, on both arguments, both the accrual and the relation back argument. And for the reasons stated here today, I would say she hasn't proven her burden on either, and we would ask that the dismissal of Saxon Mortgage, Inc. be affirmed. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Lippa.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Lissa Colt, attorney registration number 43054, appearing on behalf of Deutsche Bank National Trust Company. I'm going to try and cover quite a bit in a short amount of time, so I'm going to sort of skip around and to the highlights and cover what Mr. Schumacher mentioned, and I'm sure you'll interrupt me along the way. In any event, Mr. Schumacher is correct in the sense that this is, in terms of fraud and the fact, I mean, it is a two-prong test. In situ, we're talking about whether a person has been fraudulently deceived about the nature of the document. And then the second part, which is really what's at issue here, is so that he or she is excusably ignorant about what has been signed. Ms. Zamora seems to claim that the trial court applied an objective standard. And while the trial court did reference somewhat of what appears to be an objective standard in saying, a person of ordinary prudence and caution, it based its conclusions on eight separate factors, A through H, in its actual judgments. And originally I had thought about going through all of them. I'll mention a few. But number one, in addition to that, it was actually Ms. Zamora who signed the warranty deed. Ms. Zamora testified that Mr. Medina placed his hand over most of the deed when she signed it and that she could not see the entirety of the document, yet she nevertheless proceeded to sign it. That though the legal description of the property and the amount of the loan were blank, she nevertheless proceeded to sign the warranty deed.
Excuse me if I could interrupt you, but is your essential argument then that the trial court did in fact apply a subjective test?
That is correct, Your Honor. I believe that what counsel is attempting to do here is using that language that the trial court used, person of ordinary prudence and caution, to suggest that the trial court used an objective standard. However, when you look at the trial court's full analysis, their conclusions of law and the findings of fact that they made, it's clear that they, reviewed this under a subjective standard. Ms. Zamora, in her brief, points to Zimmerman versus Luce for that standard. In terms that it should be a subjective standard such that, each case should be considered on its own merits as to the particular individual, his mentality, awareness, and experience in determining ability and the right to rely.
Well, excuse me for interrupting, sure. My recollection is that you said in your brief that the trial court implicitly applied a subjective standard. Am I recalling that correctly?
I believe that was the case. I was not the attorney who wrote the trial brief, but I believe that was the case, Your Honor. I believe a subjective standard was looked at, whether the trial court viewed Ms. Zamora as a person of, as a person of ordinary prudence and caution, or whether they use a subjective standard. Either way, it looks like when you look through the trial court's conclusions of law on this, that it viewed this as under a subjective standard. If you look at it's CD page 1485 of the judgment, it says, considering the totality of these facts and circumstances, and those were the facts and circumstances set forth in A through H, the court is compelled to conclude that Ms. Zamora was not excusably ignorant about the facts and circumstances of this conveyance. And that would suggest that even though somewhat of an objective standard was mentioned, that this whether there was fraud in the fact of and whether she was excusably ignorant was reviewed under a subjective standard. If there's no other further questions on that, I'll move on to the next issue. With respect to the spurious liens, Ms. Zamora next asserts that the trial court committed reversible error in failing to fully analyze the WASIA deed of trust as a spurious document for containing material misrepresentations or false claims under Colorado Revised Statute 3835-2013. Now, it does appear that the trial court looked to the definition of spurious documents under 3835.201.3 in analyzing her claim. However, we would maintain that the proper statutory provision that it should have been reviewed under is 3835.201.4, which talks about a spurious lien as opposed to a spurious document. And that sets forth a spurious lien means a purported lien or claim of lien that is not created, suffered, assumed, or agreed to by the owner of the property it purports to encumber. At least that's the provision that we would relate to. A lien under this statutory section is defined as an encumbrance on real or personal property as security for the payment of the debt or performance of an obligation. Given that the deed of trust at issue was in fact a lien, it would seem that the analysis should have more properly been done under this section, subsection 4, as opposed to subsection 3. To the extent that these provisions require statutory interpretation in terms of which one is to be relied on, we looked at in Martin versus People versus State of Colorado, 27P3D846, the Supreme Court of Colorado spent a considerable of time discussing statutory construction with regard to which principle of which section would apply. The Supreme Court in Martin found that when the language of the statute itself is clear, that it need not look to the rules of statutory construction. The court in Martin went on to say that if the statutory language does not unambiguously establish the purpose, the General Assembly's purpose in enacting this statute, or if the statutory provisions appear to conflict, then other factors, such as legislative history, prior law, or the consequences of a given construction, are looked at.
Ms. Cole, would you spend some time, please, on the holder in due course issue? And in particular, I'm interested in your approach to the close relationship doctrine that is argued by Ms. Zamora's counsel.
Sure. In terms of the close relationship doctrine that Ms. Zamora seems to point to is based in that Stotler v. Geithner or v. Gebank case that Mr. Schumacher mentioned. And that doctrine basically provides that if the signers of the note are able to prove close connectedness between the original payee of the note and the assignee, then such a relationship can invalidate the assignee's claim of holder in due course status and allows the defenses that would normally not be available as against a holder in due course to be applied. And I think where this is where this seems to lead to based on the reading of the cases on point is it goes to good faith in terms of if there's such a close relationship between the parties such that the assignee would know of the conduct at issue, it could negate the good faith and therefore negate holder in due course status. In the Stotler case, it talks about the underlying basis for the doctrine itself, and it indicates that the two companies have to have an established, ongoing, interconnected business relationship. And in another case, Alice Chalmers Credit Corporation versus Horbalt, which is an Ohio appeals case, it talks about five factors that are indicative of a close relationship. The transferee's drafting of forms used by the transferor, approval or establishment of the transferor's procedures by the transferee, direct contact, heavy financial reliance upon the transferee by the transferor, and a common or connected ownership or management of the transferor. Now, in neither the Stotler case or this Ohio case, is there any reference to the fact that being subsidiaries is really the determining factor?
It's one of, but it is one of the determining
It is one
factors.
Of them, but it's not the sole factor. I guess is my point. It's more so. My understanding is that it's more so a showing of whether one company has control. The relationship is so close that one company would control the other. And in this case, I don't think that Ms. Zamora has demonstrated that. As an initial matter, it was previously stipulated too that the trust took the note and the deed of trust, which secured it, without any actual knowledge of wrongdoing on the part of Saxon. And further, Barbara Campbell of Deutsche Bank testified at the trial that she was not employed by Saxon. She didn't know of the corporate structure of the various Saxon entities, and the Deutsche Bank's compensation was not tied to the master servicing agreement or what the servicer would do. This would seem to demonstrate that Saxon and Deutsche are not in a close relationship, or that Deutsche would be in a position to know any of the underlying, you know, issues. Also, Ms. Campbell testified that Saxon Funding Management sold this and thousands of other notes to Saxon Asset Securities for $730 million.
I notice that your time is up.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Call.
I want to address primarily the statute of limitations argument. The record, you can review the record, and at page 587 of the CD record, the allegation is it was after December 2005, not as of December 2005. So there is nothing on this record that the trial court had that would establish definitively when Samora knew of both the injury and its cause, which is the requirement under Colorado law. Now, this case, this should relate back to her answer, because despite the argument made by Mr. Lippa, the answer sets forth several things that are listed as defenses. More appropriately, they should be viewed as counterclaims. However, each one, or a lot of those, referenced Libby and Saxon specifically. Now, the mistake here was invited by Deutsche when it self-identified itself as Saxon repeatedly in that complaint and its amended complaint.
Mr. Schumacher, your time is up as well.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel for your presentations this afternoon. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect an opinion to issue in due course.